The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Oh, happy Monday, everybody. Welcome to Scorebox. These are your headlines. The rally rolls on. The Dow and the S&P clinching their best week of the year so far as investors cheer signals that major central banks are on course for cutting interest rates. Four men are charged with terror offences and Russia observes a day of mourning after at least 137 people are killed in an attack on a Moscow concert hall.
IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva says the Chinese economy faces a fork in the road as policymakers and CEOs gather for the country's flagship business conference in Beijing. Turning a tide, promising data out of Germany points to a pickup in business sentiment as the head of the country's state-owned development bank tells CNBC they're on the right track.
Our business model in Germany is clearly challenged, but the German economy, given that we have such a strong Mittelstand, is very resilient, and therefore I'm confident that after time we will clearly adjust and remain competitive.
And Japanese auto giant Nissan prepares to launch its new business plan. That's amid deepening competition in the EV space. We'll be speaking exclusively with the CEO, Makoto Uchida. That's at 9:20 CET.
Good morning, everyone. We're looking at some new forecasts fresh from Goldman Sachs today. Really interesting because we had a strong central banking week last week. Markets across the United States making further territory, but also markets here in Europe also keeping pace. So the question is, what do you do with this market where, I mean, the FTSE for me is the interesting one. We've seen an escalation to levels that the FTSE struggled to hold in the past. So do you cash out at this point or do you continue to invest? And the reality is Goldman Sachs now lifting its targets. And we saw an element of this at the start of the year where some of those year-end targets have been achieved earlier than expected. So a lot of the investment banks were lifting those targets. Here we go again. And Goldman Sachs saying now sees 8,200 on the FTSE from the 7,900. Don't forget we hit the 7,930 level in the Friday session. Goldman's raising its 2024 Stock 600 target. We got to 509 Friday session. They are now saying instead of 510, they see 540. So for this year, potentially more upside for the European markets.
Good morning. I've got the note in front of me. Let me just go through a few of the bits as well. It says over the past 6 months, European equities rose 12%. And all of this rally has been driven by PE expansion rather than earnings. Our freshly built PE model suggests SXXP valuations can expand 2.5% over 12 months. Etc. etc. European equities trade at a historical discount to US equities, even when we adjust their 12-month forward PE to medium-term expected profit peg ratio. Optimism phase. They're saying the last one of the equity cycle in which multiples tend to rise while profit growth slows. Karen's gone through the numbers with you, but I'll just say a few more of the details. Our PE and EPS top-down macro models imply a target of 540, as Karen said, in 12 months, 6% return, 9% with divvies as well. There's a lot more in there, but that is the essence of it. But also talking about the economic growth picking up. As that happens, valuations should rise. There is one uncomfortable truth within this, I'm afraid, and that is as the economic growth picks up, that is not as necessarily disinflationary, deflationary, or actually the right environment for rate cutting.
Earnings are Kering. We saw the French market derailed last week by one main stock, and that was Kering, which roiled the rest of the luxury sector and a lot of concentration across in the French market. So, I mean, the stock market last week, if you look at French stocks, actually fell in contrast to the others. So even though we had a fairly decent trading week for European stocks, and you saw that reflected in all-time highs again on the broader European markets, not contributing last week was the French market. German stocks certainly did some heavy lifting, but we didn't see it across the board. So could we have that sort of canary in the coal mine where it just takes one stock to impact one sector in Europe that traps us back in a range?
Okay, it's a very good point. I just want to move on to the auto sector, if I may. a very troubled sector in many ways, but one which carries great hope, not only for China, but for all kinds of industries. We have an interview with the CEO of Nissan at 9:20 Central European Time, Mr. Uchida. And ahead of that, there is a new set of announcements out from Nissan, which says 30 models will be launched by the fiscal year 2026, of which 16 will be electrified. You can see where the impetus is there for a company which has put on about 13% to the upside this year. Dividends and buybacks to target total shareholder return of more than 30%. New business ventures to unlock a potential 2.5 trillion yen in additional revenues by the fiscal year 2030, targeting more than 6% operating margin by full year 2026. Again, 6% operating margin doesn't sound that much, does it, to everybody, really? Combustion engine ICE passenger vehicle models to be refreshed by the fiscal year 2026. Target 1 million unit sales in the fiscal year 2026 in China. So there's plenty there as well. Safe to say, as Karen opened the show saying as well, this was an extraordinary week last week for US equities, but for global equities as well, as they seem to say, right, the rate cuts are coming. Of course, we've seen action from the SMB, a bit of a surprise to some as well. But how quickly can they come? And will valuations start to teeter if we don't get them as quickly as possible?
Oh, US market still rallying, as you can see, in the Nasdaq in particular for the Friday session, even though we saw a modest fade elsewhere on the Dow and the S&P 500. But for the trading week, all major indices still in positive territory, about 2% up for the Dow, about 2.25% plus on the S&P. A little bit more eked up for the Nasdaq, 2.85% for the trading week. So very strong performance. Nvidia, again, the AI name that's dominated in recent months. It was the one that floated to the top for the Nasdaq, another 38-point contribution from the Nvidia trade, but also for the S&P 500 as well. So again, another feature underlying that market. It was technology, those big communication services plays that were the top performing sector for the markets last week. The weaker element was actually real estate. And that is interesting as we talk about interest rate sensitivity in a week that was loaded with central banking communication. I want to take you to Treasuries because we did see a slightly weaker trade on those yields drifting off from high levels a week prior, 4.20 where we got to on that 10-year. So around about 10 basis points shaved off the 10-year yield at the shorter end, slightly more moves. And you can see morning session with 4.6. I want to take you to the dollar as a result. We did still see some strength in dollar trades. Cable, we're 126.10 this morning, so inching higher, taking euro with it, 108.18 in the morning trade. And dollar yen on the back foot too. So a little bit of weakness cropping up this morning for the greenback. We're 151.22. But that said, you can see from that level that the yen didn't really have much mileage on the back of the Bank of Japan moving on interest rates and taking them out of negative territory. We saw a little of gyration during the trading week that got us back to 150, but here we are, 151 this morning. Dollar yuan saw some weakness last week as well. To the Asian markets, what we've got at this stage, Japanese stocks are in decline. We're down 474 points, matched against modest uptick across the rest of the boards from Hong Kong to China and on Australia, up 0.5%. Interesting communication out of the Chinese today, pledging to treat foreign companies on the same way as they treat domestic peers. All that while they're also talking about cutting certain chip makers out of the technology platform in China, the likes of Intel, AMD. So I think that was a kind of interesting communication on two fronts here, almost in cross currents to each other. Now, let me toss it back over to you, Steve.
Thank you very much indeed for that. Well, they've been busy bees over at Goldman Sachs this weekend. They also put out a note saying it expects the S&P to end the year relatively unchanged, down around about 1%. At 5,200. But in a new note, the lender is talking about various scenarios, to be honest. It's got a downside scenario and it's got an upside scenario. So there are, it's not just one-way traffic. But they said a scenario of continued mega cap exceptionalism could see the index close out the year as high as 6,000. Now, again, I want to be balanced on this, and it's very important to say that they've also got a scenario. They've got four different scenarios in this note as well. Recession fears could push the index down to 4,500, down 14%. So like all good gamblers out there, they've got all bets covered. 6,000 is one upside scenario in the event of mega cap exceptionalism. Recession fears could push it down to 4,500. Yeah, you'd get a bus through that quote, couldn't you? Although, as I say, it's not their central scenario. But anyway, thank you for those notes this morning, Goldman's. Tech stocks have been on a tear this year with Supermicro Computer Nvidia and Meta leading S&P gains, but corporate insiders have shed hundreds of millions of their firm's shares this quarter, with the ratio of insider selling to insider buying at its highest level since the first 3 months of 2021. This according to Verity, which tracks insider trading disclosures. The move implies tech bosses could see a top on the horizon as an AI-driven rally sends U.S. equities surging to record highs. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos sold $8.5 billion worth of shares in February, and the company's chief executive Andy Jassy has sold more than $20 million of stock this year. That's almost as much as in 2022 and 2023 combined. Now, it may be a shorter week for many of us owing to Good Friday's holiday, but that doesn't mean it'll be an uneventful one. We've got plenty out there, including final reading on the fourth quarter GDP for the UK and US on Thursday before the Fed's preferred PCE measure on inflation on Friday, seen up 2.4% on the year in line with January's reading. Bond traders are buying up short-dated debt amid a bet on Fed cuts as soon as June, according to Bloomberg. Our U.S. colleagues asked the former Fed Vice Chairman, Richard Clarida, whether there is a chance we make it to 2025 without any policy loosening.
There's always a chance, but I think they think not only that they're done, but that they're going to be cutting. The dots indicate that. Obviously, the dots have their problems, but the dots indicate that. So, yes, there is a chance, but I think under a pretty broad range of scenarios, they're going to get at least one cut in this year.
Delighted to speak to a man we've been speaking to for many years, Steve Englander, who is Global Head of Research and Chief Strategist at Standard Chartered. Always a pleasure, sir. Thank you very much indeed for what is going to be a very late night or early morning for you in New York to talk to us as well. Steve, the economics looks pretty solid at the moment. There seems to be a herd coalescing around the idea that the growth is still there, that we are seeing inflation come down but not aggressively, and that the equity markets seem very happy. This seems a very comfortable scenario, and one in which, actually, should rate cuts be happening as quickly as the market thinks they're going to happen? Because at the end of the day, if the economy is this good, why cut so aggressively?
Well, I think if you're looking at the U.S., the reason is that if inflation's coming down, and if some of the upside surprise that we're seeing to payrolls and even to numbers like GDP is likely to be coming from the supply side, there's no real barrier to your cutting rates. And I think, that, you know, if you look closely at what Fed officials have been speaking about, that quite often they talk about immigration and its impact on the labor market. There's a little, you know, the productivity numbers have been good. It's uncertain whether they're going to last. But as long as we have inflation heading towards the target, and at the Tuesday or Wednesday FOMC, they indicated that they expected to cut three times with a median inflation of 2.5 or 2.6. I think the market took a lot of comfort from that they actually want to cut as opposed to being forced to cut.
Yeah, but the market's done jolly well because it obviously wanted twice as many cuts as that this year. Now it's basically hopeful that the Fed will stick with those three cuts as well. But the dot plot got a bit firmer on a couple of fronts, didn't it? On inflation and GDP going forward as well. Is a continual firming of that dot plot going to actually thwart some of those hopes for even three cuts this year?
You know, I think the, you know, cut at this stage of the year when they put three cuts, despite a little bit of disappointment in, say, the January and February CPI, but they have some sense of how things are likely to play out. I pay a lot of attention to 2024. You know, 2025, long-term cuts, lots of things can happen. I think the information there is that even with kind of that sort of modest disappointment on the inflation front, they still think that they are going to be in a position to ease. And, you know, I think with the Swiss having cut and with, you know, ECB being clear that they're going to cut no later than June, there's a lot of enthusiasm for rate cuts in markets right now.
Steve, talk us through some of the weakness that is cropping up in the U.S. economy that would justify concerns over the Fed. I mean, the consumer seems to be one area that you focused on.
Well, you know, I think there's two consumer markets. I mentioned immigration, and you know, we're talking about you know, 200,000 to 300,000 people entering the U.S. every month, and many of them being eligible to work legally within 6 months or so. And you sort of see the parts of the economy that are really growing in terms of labor. Those are the parts where immigrants often, you know, are the major contributors. But then you look at more established parts of the, you know, consumption. You see default rates going up. You see car loan rates to the moon. You see small business delinquencies going up. It seems that the Fed policy is having an impact, but the kind of supply side, by which I mentioned the increase in labor supply, is masking the fact that there's softness in the established part of the labor market. I'd say if you look at the household employment, all the gain in jobs over the last year has come from foreign-born workers, not from domestic-born workers in the U.S.
So, Steve, if you look at the way the market has traded, some of the information it's got, they've been playing at what they consider safe at this point, piling into technology names, or whether that sees the market putting technology in its own basket, immune from any potential concerns it has still around inflation, concerns it may still have around the economy, that it still sees a growth path in technology. What do you make of that approach by a lot of traders and investors at this stage?
Well, it's interesting how, you know, the market is always looking for a model, a previous episode that it can see as an echo of what's likely to happen now. And, you know, it started off, we were talking about 1973, 1970, the inflation pickup of the 70s. Now, increasingly, the market's looking at, you know, 1995 to 2000, where, you know, simultaneously you have a technology shock, you have a productivity shock. You know, the Fed doesn't cut as much, but everybody's happy because the real returns generated by new technology are so strong that they're able to support higher real interest rates than you expected. So we have to see if that plays out. It's consistent with the data that we've gotten so far. The only thing that's missing right now is the certainty or any kind of confidence yet that the new technologies are going to show up in terms of practical applications soon enough to get those E's up that you were talking about before. We're certainly seeing P's kind of nudging up.
Yeah, the proof in the pudding, isn't it, Steve? And let me ask you, too, about the U.S. dollar trade, because last week in the wash-up from all the central banking action, we had the Japanese hiking, we had the ECB talking about a spring rate cut, and we're on track when it comes to the rate cuts from the Fed. The U.S. dollar was stronger. What do you make of that trade, and does it stick around from here?
Well, I think one of the strongest negative correlates of the dollar is good news and optimism. So I think that, you know, in the world that we're in, where equities are being bid up, not just in the U.S., but globally, that's probably a weaker dollar. The one thing that the market really wants to see for the dollar weakness trade to be in place is that the Fed be at the forefront of cutters, not kind of cutting, you know, holding hands with other central banks and all moving down together, but preserving spreads. Last week, that was kind of the theme that you saw, and the market was a bit bid. But over time, I think we will get some yield compression here, and it would result in some dollar weakness, but not precipitously.
Really, really lovely. You could stay up late for us, Steve. I do appreciate it. I know it's a horrendous time in New York, especially with the time change. Thank you, sir. Steve Englander, Global Head of Research and Chief Strategist at Standard Chartered. Pro subscribers can head to the website to see how CNBC's market strategist survey says the S&P will end the year, as well as what to expect in the final trading week of the month. The US president, meanwhile, Joe Biden, has signed a new $1.2 trillion spending bill into law Saturday, funding the government for the second half of its fiscal year. It passed the Senate after several days of negotiations between lawmakers amid the threat of a government shutdown. Again, Biden called the agreement a compromise, with neither side getting everything they wanted. This after hard right outlier Marjorie Taylor Greene, yes, voted against the bill and filed a motion to oust the House Speaker Mike Johnson, of course, of the same party as her, but different part of the party. Arabile.
Well, Steve, coming up on the show, Brussels has announced plans to impose tariffs. That's on Russian grain imports. We'll have the details. of the story next for you. Plus, trade tensions are mounting between the US and China. Again, the chip sector in focus. We'll bring you the full story. That's happening later this hour. And don't miss our exclusive interview with KFW CEO Stefan Wintels. That's coming up at 7:45 CET.
Listen to CNBC's Beyond the Valley, the podcast that explores the biggest tech news from across the globe. Join me, Arjun Karpal.
And me, Tom Chitty, every week as we bring you insights into the top stories, unpack the latest trends, and find out where the industry is headed.
Now available on Spotify, Apple Music, and Google Podcasts.
Russia has charged four men with terrorism offences after at least 137 people were killed at a Moscow concert hall on Friday night. Three of the four, all from Tajikistan, pleaded guilty. ISIS has claimed responsibility, although Russian President Vladimir Putin has accused Ukraine of being involved in the attack, a claim Kyiv denies. NBC News' Matt Bradley filed this report over the weekend.
Tonight, Moscow still smoulders as the death toll from Friday night's terror attack continues to climb. At least 133 people were killed and hundreds more injured after as many as four gunmen attacked a packed house at this concert hall.
Panika, panika.
Shooting automatic weapons, throwing bombs, and dousing the building in flammable chemicals. This video showing gunmen opening fire on victims even as they huddled on the ground. I honestly thought it was a firecracker, said this witness, but these crackles, they weren't stopping. There was screaming, panic. At least some of the gunmen were able to flee, but Russian authorities say everyone has since been caught. 11 people have been arrested so far, police said, including four who participated directly in the attack. Islamic State Khorasan claimed responsibility last night, and American intelligence says they have no reason not to take the terror group at their word. Russian state TV aired videos last night they said showed interrogations of two suspects. One is asked why he did it. I did it for money, he replies. But the ISIS claim didn't stop Russian politicians from trying to blame a more familiar enemy. Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin said today the perpetrators were caught as they fled toward Ukraine, where they had expected to be welcomed. Ukraine has denied any involvement. Tomorrow will officially be a day of national mourning in Russia. Now Russians are queuing at clinics, trying to donate blood to stop their nation from bleeding.
The EU is set to impose tariffs on imports of grain from Russia and Belarus. It comes after months of farmer protests complaining about cheap imports into the bloc. And amid fears, Moscow may flood the European market with cheap wheat. Sylvia joins me. Sylvia, though, a lot of the complaints from farmers aren't just about the competence on one side of this conflict. They're also actually about the import of agricultural product from Ukraine as well. And I think that's a very important thing that we have to raise. This isn't about necessarily let's punish Russia and Belarus. It's like actually all of these regions they have concerns about, from what I understand, from what the farmers have been saying.
Totally. Cheaper imports from basically both countries, really. However, the European Union cannot just impose any sort of measures on Ukrainian imports. They also have to do something on Russian imports, because obviously in this context of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the Europeans are trying to support Ukraine. But I want to give you the detail of what's about to happen here. Essentially, according to the European Commission, what they want to do is impose a 95 euro per ton duty on cereals from Russia and Belarus, and tariffs of 50% on oil seeds and derived products. The question at this stage is, why are they doing it? On top of trying to address the concerns raised by farmers across Europe, it's also a question of ultimately bringing down revenues for Russia, and also to address the fact that Russia has, in some points, appropriated itself of Ukrainian goods, and they are trying to export that with a Russian label. So there's essentially three components here of why the European Union is looking at these tariffs. And ultimately, the question is also, why now? I've mentioned the question of the discontent among agriculture, among farmers in Europe, but there's also the question mark about why they're doing this now, because it was considered in the past, and the Europeans were saying, well, we're not going to go down this route because it could increase food prices. Now the Europeans are saying that because they're going ahead with tariffs, this is not going to increase food prices, and actually these goods will be bought elsewhere in the world. Now, I want to show you this comment from the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, addressing this proposal.
We do not want Russia to have any kind of revenues from the EU agri-food market, for example, the grain market. So putting tariffs on Belarusian and Russian grain is taking away their competitiveness. Secondly, we do not want Russian grain to influence our grain market and the agriculture in the European Union at all. And thirdly, this move makes clear that we do not want Russian grain or Belarusian grain on the EU market, but transit is still possible. And, of course, the seamless supply of grain to the Global South or other regions of the world is also guaranteed. So it's a smart move to make sure that we reach our goals, not to give Russia any revenues from the European Union and not to intervene in our grain market.
Ursula von der Leyen there speaking after a European Council on Friday. I just want to raise your attention for an upcoming meeting happening today in Brussels among European ambassadors, where they're going to decide whether or not to extend the trade benefits for Ukraine for another year. And this is important because, of course, on the one hand, you have some countries that are supportive of that. On the other, countries such as France and Poland, thinking about their own farmers, are a little bit more skeptical about going ahead with that, guys.
Yeah, it would be so much more powerful if we didn't import so much Russian LNG at the same time as well. But there you go. Utter hypocrisy.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market moving news, you can head to CNBC.com or join us again on the show with me, Steve Sedgwick, and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.